Thanks, Bill. Good evening, everybody. My name is Jimmy. I am an alcoholic and grateful to be alive and sober. And it's customary where I come from to let you know that I have a home group. It's called the Design for Living Group on the Jersey Shore. I have a sponsor. I have a service sponsor. Sponsor a lot of guys. And most importantly, I've been sober since my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was on March 28, 1987. So extremely grateful for my sobriety, extremely grateful for this way of life, and obviously extremely grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. And thank you, Phil, for the tour of Western Tennessee in the beginning. I've never been to, well, I've been to Nashville, but that's not really Tennessee. But thank you for that little tour. And it's nice to be here. And though we didn't meet each other ever and never even saw each other ever, that was a nice opening to introduce me. So that's strange, but we'll go with it. But just happy to be here. Just give you a little visual where I come from. I live on the Jersey Shore. I'm 60 miles south of New York City on the ocean. The locals like to call this area the Irish Riviera. Members of Alcoholics Anonymous like to call it cirrhosis by the sea. There's a lot of drinking. There's a lot of partying going on. And it's one of those places, you know, from Labor Day to Memorial Day, we just, you know, everyone from North Jersey, New York comes down to our beaches and takes us hostage. But I love where I live, and that's it. Phil, 45 minutes? All right. So I'll just jump in this real quick. You know, it's really important to let you know that I was born perfect and I was quickly handed over to these two character defects called mom and dad. And though I make a little joke about that, the truth of the matter is that's the way I grew up, you know, that it's always been someone else's fault for the way I feel. And, you know, what I found out about myself, this delusion is something that set in very early. And, you know, I'm growing up in this very blue collar, this very in the city. It's blue collar. Everyone's a cop. Everyone's a fireman. Everyone's a union worker. Everyone's, you know, where my dad's a butcher. I mean, and it's just it's a great place to live growing up. I knew nothing of anything outside of my neighborhood, you know, and in my neighborhood, you know, the only requirement for membership in my neighborhood was five or more kids. So every family had a lot of kids. Every family had a lot of, you know, parties. There was always something going on. And it was just a great place to really grow up. But these parents who really, looking back, all they ever tried to give me was, you know, good morals, good values, a good education. You know, for whatever reason, you know, I just took all that stuff and I rolled it up into a ball and I tried to stuff it right down their throats. You know, there was something about me, and I'll talk more about that, but there was something about me that just didn't feel right in this family. And I don't know why. You know, I didn't know why at that time, you know. You know, growing up, I'm 63 years old. I'll be 64 in a couple of weeks. You know, I grew up in that time when, you know, my mom would open up the door at 8 o'clock in the morning and you would, you know, walk out the door and they knew you would come back eventually, you know. And so I became like a little street kid right from the get go, you know, and pretty quickly, you know, all those people that I looked up to, like my brothers and my dad and, you know, just my uncles and just men I thought were, you know, really important in my life were quickly substituted for the neighborhood guys, you know, the bookie, you know, the corner bartender, the older guys, you know, and these were my idols all of a sudden. And, you know, it wasn't really a lot of education going on in my life. I mean, I always like to joke around that if you got a guy like me and Darren standing on the corner and you drove by, you would say, hey, there's a dead bird. Me and him would probably look up, you know, we weren't too bright, you know, but it was a place that seemed safe. It seemed like a place that, you know, it was home, you know, and, you know, with all these kids and with all these big families, you know, there was always an occasion. There was always a party for a birthday or a christening or a graduation. And the common theme at every party was King Alcohol. King Alcohol was present. So right from an early age, 5, 6, 7 years old, you know, it's disease of perception we always talk about. I would see, you know, a lot of drinking going on. And, you know, early on, I just believed, you know, that alcohol equated fun. You know, alcohol equated, you know, problem solved. Alcohol equated, you know, some sort of freedom, because it just seemed like everyone changed when they had a few drinks in their system. Now, growing up in a city, you know, there's a bar on every corner. So, you know, we'd go up to the schoolyard to play ball and, you know, I would walk up that street and there was a corner bar and I'd look in that bar and I'd see all you guys in there playing pool or watching a ball game or shuffleboard. You know, I'd see all you pretty women in there trying to pick up these guys. And again, I didn't take a drink, but my mind is being molded for this idea that I can't wait to do that one day, you know. And that day came, you know, I came at age 13 years old when I picked up my first drink. But prior to picking up that first drink, you know, I witnessed another thing, too. And that's the ease and comfort that does come by that first drink. You know, I got this guy called Dad. He's cutting. He's baffling and powerful. My dad's a real tough guy. My dad's, like I said, he's a butcher. You know, those white aprons that butchers wear. My dad was the kind of guy like you wouldn't know if he killed a cow that day and slaughtered it. Or he pulled somebody out at a red light and just started beating up on a guy. That's the kind of guy he was. I don't know why he was like that. He was an angry guy. He was a Korean War vet. He would be 95 if he was still alive. So he was that generation where there's no hugs, I love you, or any of that other stuff. Like many guys that are my age, you know, I grow up with a lot of daddy issues, you know, all that nonsense, you know. But what I would witness as a 5-year-old, 7-year-old, 8-year-old, is that ease and comfort that comes at once, because my dad would walk in the house like clockwork at 5 o'clock every night. And my mom would drink these two pitchers, one called martinis, the other one called Manhattans. And what I would witness, my dad would take that first drink and he would become another person, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He became that guy that wanted to have a catch in the backyard. He became that guy that wanted to have, you know, make some laughs and just have some family time and that kind of stuff. But again, don't let me fool you with that either, because there were those days, and maybe some of you guys had some of these kind of days in your home growing up, because my dad would take that first drink and all of a sudden there was violence in the house and there was plates going across the kitchen and there was kitchen chairs being flown around. And all of a sudden, you know, once in a while, one of us young kids would be flying in the air because my father would just explode with this rage and anger. And, you know, guys like at that age, you know, I mean, well, that generation, I should say, you know, the way they handled problems in my neighborhood or in my family was they drank at it. You know, they didn't talk about how they felt. They internalized everything. And right from an early age, that's what I started to do. You know, I lived in fear. I lived with insecurities. And now I'm living with something that really dogged me for a long time. And that's, I live with a lot of secrets in my life, because the stuff that went on in my house, you never left your house. That stuff that went on in my neighborhood never left your neighborhood. So everything was internalized at a young age. Now, that doesn't make me alcoholic, but boy, does that give me a good reason to drink sometimes, because I'm so restless, irritable, and discontent most of the time and a lot of the time, you know. So that day does come. It's, I'm 13 years old. I can remember. It's 51 years ago. I can remember like it happened this morning. I'm in a cemetery with five guys. I can still remember their full names. And here comes that first bottle. It's called Colt 45 malt liquor. And I put my hand in there and I start drinking on that Colt 45 malt liquor. Here comes that second bottle. It's Mohawk blackberry brandy. I start drinking on that blackberry brandy. And, you know, my first opportunity to drink turned into a blackout, turned into puking purple for about 2 weeks. Took a beating from my father. My mother grounded me for life, you know, but the hook was in. The hook was in. I found something that just quieted that insecurity. I found that. Now, I've heard this from a million podiums. I'm sure you guys did, too. But there was something about that alcohol, you know. And very quickly, you know, the chase was on for that elusive feeling. Now, what I understand today, and I'm very assured of this because I know what I suffer from, I'm alcoholic right out of the gate. And why I can say that with confidence and assurance is this, because I know what I suffer from today. I know on that day, that first day drinking, though I didn't become an everyday drinker, I just know that when I started to drink, I couldn't control the amount, that I had no power, choice, or control in my body once I started to drink. You know, all bets were off. I just wanted to drink. I know after coming to the day later, you know, and being grounded and all that other stuff, I know that the second leg of this three-legged stool set in, because this thing called the obsession started to happen to me. Where all of a sudden this idea that's so strong and overcomes all other ideas, I can't wait till after the football game. I can't wait till after the dance. I can't wait till next Friday. I can't wait. I can't wait. I can't wait. And I can't wait to be with my guys again and recreate what just happened the other night, because that was utopia, you know. But I also know something else about myself looking back now. I know that third leg of that three-legged stool, was quieted down. The spiritual malady deep down inside me, the noise that went on inside me prior to that first train. Now, again, you know, what could a 13-year-old be, you know, filled with that with, you know? And it's like I said, it's just this walking on eggshells around my family, walking on eggshells around my father. You know, I think we all have a moment in our lives when things just change, you know, and that happened for me prior to my first drink. You know, I was in fifth grade. I'm in a public school system. I'm with all these kids. And all of a sudden, my parents pulled me out of that and they put me into a Catholic school where I knew nobody. You know, and I met these new creatures. They're called nuns, you know, and priests and, you know, the Catholic religion. I mean, all this stuff that was so foreign to me all of a sudden became my new way of life, you know, and, you know, I resented my parents. I couldn't see that they were trying to improve my education. I couldn't see that they were trying to get me out of a bad public school system at the time. You know, I just took it personal. Like I take everything that personal. And what do? I get angry at it. I drink at it. You know, I do those kind of things, you know, and I you know, looking back, I mean, that's when really, you know, I had my first drink very shortly right after that. What I could tell you about taking that first drink is this, just like my old sponsor used to say, you know, taking that first drink, man, I stepped right on a road that went straight to hell, you know, because over the next 16 years of my life, my alcoholism not only got progressive, there was another thing that started to get progressive, and that was my behavior. And all of a sudden, living on the street or hanging on the street with the guys, you know, doing crimes, becoming a little criminal, you know, a wannabe wise guy, all those kind of stuff, you know, I just started to get, you know, into a few jackpots and getting a lot of trouble, you know, not no big time arrests or anything like that, but, you know, drunk and disorderly, you know, pulled up, you know, all the little nitty bitty things. Well, they shouldn't say it like that, but you know, the point I'm trying to get at is that, you know, I just became a guy that my parents never expected me to come. You know, they did not see this coming in their future. This kid that was just totally out of control. Couldn't stop drinking, always in trouble. So unlike the other, you know, four children they had. And I became, you know, that little black sheep and problem in the family. And let's not even discuss what he's going on. But, you know, so, you know, like I say, you know, I go through the early years of my life, high school, you know, I go on to the greatest 10 years of my life called college. I mean, that was a great time. Me and 9 friends went out to the mountains of Pennsylvania. Maybe not like your mountains, but the mountains of Pennsylvania, you know, and I like to say I was there 10 years. I like to tell you I was there 4 years. I mean, I made it 1 year and I got thrown out of school because I just couldn't stop drinking. You know, what was amazing to me was that the first drink was getting me loaded. And even though when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, when I heard that phrase, the first drink gets you drunk. Come on, man. How lame can you guys be? It's like the last 20 drinks. It's the outside issue stuff. That's the stuff that's getting me loaded. I couldn't understand this first drink concept. And like many of us, I have goals, I have aspirations, I have dreams, you know, believe it or not, I do growing up. I want to be something. I don't want to be a union worker, even though I became a union worker, but I wanted to do something more in my life. But the problem was this, I took that first drink. And see, I didn't know when I took that first drink, the chain of events that would happen after that. I didn't understand the idea, the phenomena of craving and the allergy that goes on with an alcoholic of my variety. You know, I didn't understand about this obsession. You know, I didn't understand the chase for the next drink until I got to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. So somewhere along the lines, you know, I like to say that God just cracked my skull open, you know, and in my skull, in my mind, he put this chalkboard, you know, and on this chalkboard, there was these three emotions. You know, shame, guilt, and remorse. And it just seemed like through the early years of my life, right into my 20s, I always just created some sort of feeling because of the behaviors that I was displaying. You know, the shame of walking out of relationships, the shame of hurting my family, the shame of being arrested again, you know, the guilt of the people I was doing crimes to, and the guilt of hurting my parents and my brothers and sisters, and the remorse of that. You know, and there wasn't enough alcohol in the world to fill that void. But here's the delusion that I think some of us walk in here with, and is that I thought when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and put the plug in a jug, that all those feelings that I felt would just magically go away. Now, I don't know why I thought that way. I just thought that, you know, when I stopped drinking, everything was just going to fall into place. I'd get a great job, have a house, kids, all that other stuff. but that's not my story, you know, and maybe that's the story for some other people. But what happened was, like a lot of my friends, you know, I would watch a lot of my friends just move on in life. They just seemed they were well adjusted to reality. You know, they were able to start families, finish college, you know, get a career, you know, meet that woman, you know, have a family, you know. And though I wanted all those things, what I didn't understand is I took that first drink and I would sit in that bar like many of us sit in a bar, and I'd have all those ideas in my mind, the things I wanted to do, but I would take that first drink. You know, and what happened to me was, you know, I was in a bar one day, and, you know, this is how I do relationships with women. So this is, you know, beware, you know, there's a good looking woman against the wall over there. I see my sister. I say, hey, I'll buy you an illegal substance if you introduce me. She does. And that's how I meet women in the bars, you know. And, you know, I meet this woman in a bar and I get married 7 months later because I'm under that delusion. Now, I'm a double edged sword guy. I don't know if anyone else is like that, but I'm blaming everyone for everything that I'm doing, whether it was my parents, whether it was this girlfriend, whether it was my job, whether it was the boss, whether it was my neighbors, whether it was the dog. It's always someone's feeling for the way I feel deep down inside. This is why I believe many people have a problem taking stock, honestly, when they come into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, because they don't want to look at the stuff that's inside. But, you know, I meet this woman you know, 4 months into the marriage, I walk out of the marriage. I'm 25 years old at the time. Now, I've been in a lot of trouble up to this point, but, you know, at 25 years old, I'm under that delusion that if I just get married, if I could just do this external thing, because that's the double-edged sword part of me, is not only am I blaming everything for the way I feel out there inside of me, I'm also on the hunt for something out there to fix me inside here. So that's all about money. That's all about women. That's all about drinking and drugs and all that other stuff. Nice cars. You know, I'm that real chameleon. I pretend to be someone, you know, that I'm not, just so you like me. Man, how lame is that? But that's the way I was, you know, that's the way I felt. So I'm here. I'm in this marriage for 4 months. Now, the problem about being married is I don't like her. She don't like me. I'm irresponsible. I'm non-caring. I don't know this word that we talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous sometimes. I think it's sex, but intimacy, I have no idea about trust and affection for another person. I don't know anything about the assets that we all have because I've never practiced them, like love and tolerance and compassion for others. I just, you know, everything is about me. I'm selfish and self-centered to the core. And 4 months into the marriage, you know, I make a decision to walk out of the marriage because that's what most cowards do. And I walk out of the marriage because, you know, drinking's more important than being a married man. And what I do is I take off from my home away from home, which is Boca Raton, Florida. And I go down to Florida and, you know, like I said, I'm 25 years old and this is what's going on. I'm sitting in this $1 million condo, a family friend's condo, and all glass windows. I'm looking at the beach. I'm looking at the boats. I'm looking at the bikinis. And in my mind, I'm thinking this is what every man would want. Just to have a place like this to be free. But see, I'm not like that. I'm getting that knock every door like many of us do get that knock. And it's the four horsemen of showing up, of terror, frustration, bewilderment, despair. Every morning I'm waking up to the shame, the guilt, the remorse of walking out of this marriage, just leaving this woman and nobody knows where I'm at. I'm down here for 7 months in Florida. No one knows where I'm at. Nobody. I wouldn't call anyone. Every morning with that knock and the fear and the insecurity and the anger inside of me, you know, the only thing I know what to do when I'm at this point in my drinking where I don't even need to take a drink yet. I just need to crack the bottle of a bottle of Johnny Walker Red. And when I crack that seal, I could feel the grandiosity already coming back. But I take that first drink. And when I take that first drink, what happens is that perfect little kid comes out to play. And all of a sudden, he's pointing his fingers at everyone for the way he feels. It's their fault. It's her fault. It's their fault, you know. And I got this list from here to Kingsport, Tennessee, of all the people that it's their fault for the way I feel. I can't look inside. I can't be honest with myself. You know, the golden rule of recovery is rigorous honesty. I don't know how to do that. I'm deceitful. I'm a liar. I'm dishonest about everything that's going on in my life. So I come back to New Jersey eventually, and I'm about 29 years old. Matter of fact, I just turned 20. No, I'm younger than that. I'm around 27 years old. And, you know, I come back and there's so much shame of what I did that I don't call anyone when I come back to New Jersey. I'm just filled with shame that I don't even have the nerve to call my parents or my brothers and sisters. So I make a decision. The decision is I'm going to live on the streets. And for the next 18, 19 months of my life, I just lived homeless. I put my head down wherever I could put my head down. I became a guy who started to panhandle. I'm a guy who just started to steal. I'm a guy who just, you know, my old sponsor used to say this all the time, you know, one night on the street is one night too many. And what happened over a course of time is I've lost time. Over a period of time, I lost me. Over a period of time, I shut down emotionally. I shut down spiritually. You know, I was starting to shut down physically. I was having a lot of physical problems. I was having a lot of sickness. I was having a lot of bad things were just happening, you know, and I was lost. And all I knew was King Alcohol was the only answer to my problem. And I would drink on a daily basis and, you know, and just hope for the best not tomorrow. And what happened one day is I walked into a bar and I met an old timer in a bar that I knew from the neighborhood. And he looked at me and said, Jimmy, they're hiring guys like you. I said, why? He goes, they're hiring guys like you at Newark Airport. You should go to Newark Airport. They're hiring guys just like you. And back then, there was an airline called People's Express that eventually became United, eventually became Continental. And the job was they would hire guys like me or maybe you. And the idea was to take that pile of luggage that's over there and put it on that plane that's over there. Now, I like to segue a little bit all the time here because if you flew through Newark Airport in the 80s and you're still waiting for your luggage, well, we'll make amends after this meeting. But that was the job. You know, it was to load the airplanes with your luggage, you know? So I go into this big hangar and I'm sitting at this hangar and I'm dying. I'm dying. What I know now is called alcoholism. I am a total mess. I'm 29 years old. I look like I'm 129 years old. And for years, I couldn't tell you how I really felt until I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I opened that blue book, you know, where I went to page 8 and Bill's story. You know, Bill gives us his first step description, which I think fits all of us when he says that no words could tell the loneliness and despair I felt in the bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I met my match of an overwhelmed alcohol was my master. And I sat in a metal chair like all the church basements I've sat in for the last 34 years. The same feeling. I sat in this metal chair and I felt so lost. And I think maybe drinking's a problem. 29 years old, I'm just acknowledging that maybe alcohol could be a problem. And in the next couple of minutes, a complete stranger sat next to me. And after a few awkward minutes, he looked at me and said, what's your problem? And for whatever reason, well, I know the reason today, it's called God's grace. I spit my life story up on this guy in about 10 minutes. He looked at me and said, I have the solution for you. And I said, what's that? He goes, where do you live? I said, wherever I could put my head down. He pulled a piece of paper out. He wrote down a street on this paper because it was his pre-cell phone, pre-beeper day. He goes, do you know where the street is? I said, yeah, it's in my old neighborhood. Put a number in front of that street and goes, is it possible for you not to take a drink today? I said, I have no idea. I feel like drinking right now. It's like 10:30 in the morning. He goes, try not to drink today and meet me at this and be at this address at 7 o'clock tonight. And all I could say is, but for the grace of God, at 7 o'clock that night, with my knees knocking, filled with fear, even asking myself, did I even meet somebody this afternoon? It is so bizarre that I was in front of this address, cold, stone, sober. When all of a sudden, a 1979 Chevy Impala pulled up. And in that car was the stranger with a bunch of other strangers. And they opened the window and they said, the most spiritual thing you ever hear in Alcoholics Anonymous, get in the car. And I got in a car with these men, and they took me around the corner to my grammar school, St. Paul's Greenville, where I had such contempt with the priests, the nuns, Catholicism, goodness, anything good in my life at this point was I had such contempt in. And they walked me into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've been with you guys ever since. And for years, I thought it was bingo. Who knew? It was AA. It was the Jersey City Young People. And I walked into this meeting, and I remember walking down those metal stairs. And I remember smelling the gray battleship paint that every Catholic school in America paints their basements with. And I remember walking down those basement stairs, you know, And what I realized today is walking into grace doesn't feel like walking into grace. It feels like I was walking out of chaos because I was walking down those stairs. And as I walked past that cafeteria as a sixth grader, eighth grader, I looked in that cafeteria and I thought about all the dreams, aspirations, and goals I had. And here I am walking into something I have no idea I'm walking into. And as I started to walk down to the end of that hall, I met the most important person you'll ever meet, Alcoholics Anonymous. We call him the greeter. And this gentleman put his hand out to me, and I grabbed that flimsy reader, and he pulled me into the room of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, "Welcome, kid. You never have to drink again. Here's a half a cup of coffee. Sit up front because you'll probably be here pretty good. You'll probably hear better. And most importantly, the most important thing that he gave to me that day, and probably I have to give to any newcomer or anyone that shows up to AA that we're all responsible for, he gave me a piece of dignity that night. Because he didn't care what I looked like. He didn't care what I smelled like. He didn't care that every other word was a profanity that came out of my mouth. He said, keep coming back, kid. And that was day one. At the end of that meeting, that complete stranger that I met in Newark Airport walked up to me and said, listen, I'm your sponsor, and this is your home group. Problem solved. I have no idea what a sponsor is. I have no idea what a home group is. But apparently on day one, I had both of them. So the interview process was taken right out of the way. And so this guy, Richie Snow, God rest his soul, died with 37 years of sobriety, became my sponsor. And I'll tell you, you know, there's a tendency to beat up the guys who don't know the big book by heart or from word to word, because I can tell you right now, the guys I got sober with didn't know the difference between a phone book and a big book. But I'll tell you what they did. They showed up on your porch when you needed help. They came to your house when these men were real trusted servants. And what they did for me on day one was that night they put me up in a hotel room because they knew I had nowhere to go. They went to a department store and they bought me clothes because they knew I didn't have any clean clothes. They fed me that night. That's the way they took care of that newcomer back then. They didn't care if you knew the book. They didn't care if you knew the steps. They didn't even talk about that stuff. They just wanted to make sure that you were okay. And they put me up in this hotel. And I'll tell you, I remember day two like it happened this morning. Day two, I wake up. I'm in complete terror. I want to drink. I'm afraid. I don't even know where I'm at. I'm really mocus. I'm really shot out. You know, but these guys came to me that morning. And I did something that is very different for a guy like me. Matter of fact, it's pretty different probably for a lot of us, you know, especially when you shut down emotionally and you shut down, you know, spiritually, you just shut down. Like, I don't know how to share how I feel. I internalize everything. You know, I have become my father and I don't even know it. And this guy, Richie, pulls up and I shed an emotion. And tough guys like me don't share emotions because that's against the street code. But I shed an emotion. What I said to this guy, Richie, is I'm scared. You never tell anyone you're scared. And I'm scared because I want to drink. And he said, I know you do. And this is what I witnessed as a trusted servant that he was. He called up his wife and said, take me off the calendar today. I'm going to be with this newcomer. He wound up taking me to 3 meetings that day. He took me to 3 diners that day to feed me. I must have drank 700 cups of coffee. But guess what? I felt like a member of Alcoholics Anonymous on day two. Day 7, I can remember like it happened yesterday. Day 7, Richie walks up to me. I'm at my new home group with my new sponsor. Though I have no idea what's going on. I'm just going to AA meetings. He walks up to me and goes, listen, we're going to have a commitment here. I want you, a business meeting here. I want you to take the commitment as the ashtray cleaner. The ashtray cleaner. This is where I've come to, an ashtray cleaner. So in my mind, I said, you know what you could do with your ashtrays. But I, of course, didn't say that to him because something happened that night. I listened to the small voice within. We all have that intuitive thing that says, you know what? This guy's not trying to hurt you. He's trying to help you. Just trust him. Take the job as the ashtray cleaner. Now, the reason why I balked at doing that was because even though I've put every possible substance in my body in this first 29 years of my life, I have never smoked a cigarette in my life. So why do I have to clean ashtrays? But thank God I listened to that small voice, because what happened was from that day to this moment right now, I've been connected and tethered to Alcoholics Anonymous through a commitment, whether it's been in my home group, whether it's been in my district, whether it's been in my area. I've had a job in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I embrace the third legacy of service because that's the thing that keeps us sober, along with the 12 steps and the fellowship in a home group. That three sides of the triangle are the most important things in my life today, and I know that. And I got to be that insignificant little dot that sits in the middle of all those three. So that really starts my, my life in AA in that first week, you know. And what happened was, you know, very quickly things got good, very quickly for a guy like me. You know, I got back with that wife that I walked out on. I got this job that was incredible, that made me a lot of money. I got a bank account. I had my first checking account. I wound up having two little AA babies. You know, to the untrained eye, it looks like normal living. It's a solution to alcoholism. Well, let me tell you, at 5 years without a drink, active in the rooms of AA, I got a rope. I just need a bridge to jump off because I'm dying of something I don't know. I'm dying of something I don't understand, or I'm dying of something we're not talking about. I'm dying of untreated alcoholism. You see, I'm under that delusion that abstinence is the solution to my spiritual malady. But guess what? I'm still that guy that's walking around just like I was when I was 10, 15, 20 years old. I got a belly filled with unmanageability. I got a belly filled with insecurity and fear. And I got such rage in me. I become the home group angry guy. How many home groups have an angry guy? Well, I was angry Jimmy in my home group because I was so filled with rage and I didn't know how to get rid of the stuff that was going on inside of me. So at 5 years without a drink, you know, I am emotionally dead. I am spiritually dead, living under this delusion that just don't drink and go to meetings. It's a solution to my problem. And I'm dying in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I do this talk on the second step and I'm paralyzed by what everyone thinks of me. So I'm lying to every one of you. And at the end of this meeting, I'm lying about this relationship with God that I don't have. You know, I read the 12 and 12 once. You know, I could tell some jokes if I need to tell. And at the end of the meeting, where we're shaking everyone's head, thanks for showing up. Thanks for this guy walks right up to me. I'm 6'4". He's 6'4". And he looks at me and says, "You're screwed." A little bit salty language. And I wanted to punch him right in the face and start a fight in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous because I don't know how to face resistance with no resistance. I don't know how to face conflict without violence because I'm still the same guy. I'm just not drinking. But I take a step back, and it's another moment of grace for me because I take a step back and I look at this gentleman and I said, "You're right. I need help." And in the summer of 1992, I find myself in a little railroad room apartment overlooking New York City on the Jersey side. And I'm getting the spiritual test. And the spiritual test looks like this. And maybe some of you guys have had this spiritual test. But this guy, Bill Grace, who came from St. Paul, Minnesota, same place my sponsor's from today, this guy's giving me the test. First question, "Jimmy, how long can you hold your breath? How long can you be in a 12-step program and not work the 12 steps? What does your relationship with God look like?" Well, you know, I believe in God, I guess, sir, but what's God have to do with this? "What makes you alcoholic?" The best I could stammer out at the time was, "I drink too much. I had no idea about the physical allergy. I had no idea about the mental obsession. I did not understand even the spiritual malady, this threefold illness that I suffer from. I had no idea what any of that stuff was." Then he asked me a question that most of you probably not, maybe you will believe, maybe you don't believe, but just the way it was in my neighborhood in the 80s. He looked at me and said, "Where's your big book?" And I said to him, "What's a big book?" Now, I'm sure there was a big book on a podium or maybe a literature table, but that's not something we talked about back then. It wasn't until the early 90s when Joe and Charlie came through the Northeast that everyone started to really, you know, the book took life back then. So here I am in this house with this guy, and he asked me one more question, but he didn't want me to answer. He goes, "Jimmy, let me ask you something. If AA works, why do you have so many problems?" Because I'm not working AA. I'm just not drinking. I am dying in the rooms of AA. And can you help me? So what started to happen that day was my life started to change. Because Bill Grace started to paint a picture for me. He started to visualize what this whole deal is all about. He talked about, "What are the two goals of Alcoholics Anonymous, Jim? Two goals of AA are really simple. Number one, don't pick up the first drink. That's the obvious one. But the real goal here is to enter the sunlight of the Spirit. And in the end, and when you enter the sunlight of the Spirit, that's a place where all these promises that are in our literature occur. It's a place where there's total freedom from the bondage of self. It's a place where a relationship with God could be formed, relationship with others could be formed, and your life could get transformed. But in order to get out to the sunlight of the spirit, you got to walk through this hallway of life and uncover, discover, and discard the things that are blocking you from it. See, when I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I heard you old-timers. You would say stuff like this: alcoholism is a soul sickness caused by a separation from God and a disconnect from each other. No wonder why I feel the way I feel. I'm disconnected from God. I'm disconnected from you. There's always been a wedge between me and you. I'm afraid to show my cards. God forbid you judge me. God forbid you don't like me. I'm paralyzed by what people think of me. I have all this insecurity. I'm almost ashamed to even say that, but that's the way I was at 29 years old. And just like I do downstairs in my kitchen, you know, we sit at my kitchen table. We go through those first two steps. Really, it's about, here's the problem. Here's a solution. Nowhere in our literature does it say AA is about getting us to quit drinking. It says quite the opposite. You can't stop quitting. You can't stop. You're powerless. Lack of power is your dilemma. You have no mental defense against the first drink. That's why you keep drinking. I remember getting on my knees with this guy, and he held my hands, and I held his hands. Now, I've been up to a lot of prayer circles at this point, but this is the first time I ever got on my knees with another man. And I held his hands. I could feel his spirit come into me. It was an amazing feeling that day. You know, there's a reading I always like to read because it's probably one of the most important readings to me. It comes out of Daily Reflections on May 1st. And this really describes what we're about to do. It's the side of myself that I refuse to look at that rules me. I must be willing to look at the dark side in order to heal my mind and my heart. Because that's the road to freedom. I must walk into darkness to find the light and walk into fear to find peace. The way the old timers used to say that was like this. Alcoholics Anonymous is like a big bonfire. Most people are walking around the fire, but eventually the fire is going to go out. If you really want to change, if you really want to grow, if you really want to have a relationship with God, you got to walk through the fire and get your ass burnt and feel the uncomfortability of change. And thank God I was willing to walk through the fire, because all he asked me to do when I got off my knees is to walk into the darkness of my life and start to uncover, discover, and discard the things that are blocking me from God and blocking me from you. And I had to do something which I thought was a weakness, but it eventually became a source of strength. I had to become vulnerable. I had to become vulnerable to another man. See, real tough guys like me, I don't trust guys. But this guy, Bill Grace, became the anchor. I went to him with everything. And I started to walk through that hallway. And I started to uncover, discover, and discard these things that have blocked me. And I started to get down to the common manifestations of living a life on self-will. And I started to look at all this rage that was inside of me. All this fear that was inside of me, these sexual harms, these financial harms, these physical harms, the emotional harms. I had a boatload of harms that I've caused to people. And I got it on paper. And then I had probably the most powerful day of my life, other than my two children being born, was my original fifth step. And why it was so powerful is because I didn't leave anything out of it. I gave this man everything. And I followed the directions that were after that fifth step, where I took that hour. And I went to a place called Liberty State Park, which is on the Hudson River on the other side of Manhattan. And I remember walking out on this pier and opening up to page 75, reading the instructions, read those first five proposals, all the stones properly in place. And I remember getting on my knees on this pier, and all of a sudden I looked to my right, and maybe a quarter mile to my right was the Statue of Liberty. I looked across the Hudson River. It's like I could touch it. The World Trade Center was right there. And I looked to my left, and there was Ellis Island, where many of our families came through. Symbols of freedom. And here I am as a 32-year-old kid on this pier. And for the first time in my life, I could feel the arms of God wrapped around me. And I knew I was going to be okay. I knew it. Tears were coming down. I didn't leave anything out. I was walking through the darkness of my life, and my life was starting to change. And I like to tell you that I got on the spiritual rocket, and my life went up, 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 and away, but that's not my story. My story is I've grown, I've hit walls, I've grown, I've hit walls. I've had second surrenders, third surrenders, fourth surrenders. You know, I'm 34 years sober now, 64 years old soon. I don't even know how many surrenders I've had. I've had a lot. But with every surrender, I've grown. And with every surrender, I've gotten closer to God. And I've gotten closer to you. You know, I fell for the biggest trap we have in Alcoholics Anonymous after that fifth step. I fell prey to comfortability. All of a sudden, my emotions took over. I feel good. Why do I have to go to any length now? All of a sudden, I've got the wife, got the kids, making money, all that stuff. I become a baseball coach. I become a basketball coach. You know, I'm working overtime. I got everything going on, right? Nothing wrong with that stuff. It's just that it overtook my primary purpose. You know, I'm on the ocean right here, and all I need to do is take the boat out on the ocean, right? I can point that boat east. And what I see when I look east is the hemisphere of the earth, right? The horizon. Beautiful sunrises here every day, right? And I could just point that boat east, and I see the same thing every day. What I don't see is how my boat is drifting from town to town to town because I'm looking east. I'm not looking behind me. And like many of us, I fall off the beam, right? And then all of a sudden, I start to get in trouble. And all of a sudden, that hallway that was so clear, that darkness that is not in my life anymore, I come back into the darkness of my life. And see, it's really easy to keep one foot in the light and one foot in the dark. But nothing ever grows in the dark. So how do I stay out in the light? Right? What happened eventually was I blew up at 10 years of sobriety. Almost drank at 13. Walked into a bar. Telling my sponsor about 20% of what's going on. Lying to everyone. Living a double life in AA. Walk into a bar. Bartender, give me a drink. Puts a drink right on the bar. 13 years sober. I understand what Dr. Bob talks about in his nightmare. Being stuck between a rock and a hard place. I don't want that drink, but God damn it, I need that drink to kill the pain of what I'm doing. Living a very bad life right now. Sober. And as I'm staring down that drink, and the angel and the devil pop out, drink it, don't drink it, drink it, don't drink it. I'm staring at that drink. All of a sudden, a hand goes around that drink and pulls it back. And when I look up, the bartender just happens to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. What are you doing? Apparently throwing my life away. And what happened was a couple of weeks later, I walked into a meeting and I met a man that became my sponsor for the next 17 years of my life. And my life changed. My life changed. That's all I could say. Adversities. We all have adversities. 1999, I was in a horrible accident. I've been retired since December 6, 1999. I went down 45 stairs. I've had 41 operations since December of 1999. 12 back operations. Just had my third knee replaced. I mean, on and on and on. I'm really 5'8", but after they put all the metal in me, I'm 6'4". It's amazing how it happened, but it's great, you know. But adversities, we all face them. But what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, the evidence is here how you get through anything. I've met people that have lost their children. I've met people that are bankrupt. I've met people who have gone through, you know, a lot of bad things. But they've stayed sober, and they, you know, we all take a hit, but they keep their head up and they keep walking through these things. And they surrender to God, and they surrender to His power, and they continue to put one foot in front of the other. You know, so I went through this divorce. I went through all these injuries. I went through all this stuff. Met a woman in AA. Who knew? Good friend of mine. She was a member of the World Trade Center's famous group, the Tower Group. And on 9/11, her home group came down with the towers. And a lot of people in her home group died on that day. But she wasn't there, thank God. And a cup of coffee became a sandwich, became a proposal. And now we're married 18 years. And our life is unbelievable because of Alcoholics Anonymous. She's sober 25 years. So there's been so many blessings. There's been so many adversities. There's been so many things that have gone on in my life. My mom died a year ago. It was last week. COVID, like many, 94 years old. Bet our money's worth, but, you know, took her down. But the good news is that my daughter let me know about a week ago that I'm going to be a first-time grandpa, like all you older guys. So I am really excited about that. So life goes, life comes, right? That's life. Right? Alcoholics Anonymous. Got very involved in some stuff that I never thought that God would put me on this path. You know, I became a reluctant GSR with 19 years sober. You know what that looks like. Your hand's going up and you have a conversation with your hand. What are you doing? What are you doing? All of a sudden you're doing something you never thought you'd be doing. went to a service assembly in Hunt Valley, Maryland. Met two old guys. I thought they were just old guys. Who knew? One was a United States trustee at large. The other one was a Northeast regional trustee. Took me under their wing. Started to see Alcoholics Anonymous in a different light. Handed me a service manual. I read the service manual. I said, here, I want you to read this page, S20. It's written by a non-alcoholic, Class A trustee, Vern Smith, Bill Wilson's lawyer. Read this. In that thing, he says, why do we have a conference? Why do we do the things we do in Alcoholics Anonymous? It's not to ensure our sobriety. We're here tonight. I know Phil knows what to do when that newcomer comes to the front door. I know what Curtis is going to do down in Kentucky when that newcomer comes to the door. So we're not here to ensure our sobriety. We're doing what we do here to help that guy out there right now who doesn't know we're in here. And how do we do that? Well, we have committee work. We have literature. We have a lot of ways we do that. Because right now, I can guarantee you something. That right now, from my house to Tennessee, there's a guy cracking open a bottle of Jack Daniels. He can't wait to wash his day away. Right now, from my house to your house, there's a single mom who has those three kids and can't wait to put them down and crack that bottle of wine and wash her day away. Right now, I can guarantee you this. From my house to your house and every hospital in between, is a baby being born destined for alcoholism. So I learned through this process that I have a responsibility. It's a small part, but it's still a responsibility for any member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that responsibility is pretty simple. It's to make sure that the doors of AA never close. And just like they were open for me on March 28, 1987, I got to do my part to make sure that these doors are open for that person who's coming behind me. It's a really simple thing to do. It's just about being willing to put some time into it. So I became, you know, this GSR, DCM. I started to go down the inverted triangle. I became the area chair. I became the alternate delegate, you know. And today I got the honor and privilege of serving my area, Area 44, Northern New Jersey, as the delegate to the General Service Conference. And why I tell you that is because, I don't know, maybe it sounds good. I don't know. I think it's just to let you know that, you know, what I've learned is that I have to be on all three sides of this triangle and that I do have a responsibility. We all do, right? 1965 in Toronto, we get the responsibility pledge. When anyone, anywhere reaches out for help, I want the hand of AA to always be there. For that, I am responsible. You know, Dr. Bob talks about four reasons why he passes this on. One, it's a pleasure. How many of us have sat across from a young man, a young woman, and we see the lights go on? And they recreate their life through Alcoholics Anonymous. What a pleasure to see that. Dr. Bob talks about this sense of duty, this responsibility that we all have. Dr. Bob talks about paying back that debt. I owe a debt to Richie Schnorr, who 12-stepped me in Newark Airport that day. I promised him I would go to any length to help anyone at any time. And then Dr. Bob talks about that last reason why we do what we do in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, is to ensure our own sobriety. Because that's the paradox. When I help you, I get better. When I help you, I get better. Or as the old timers used to say in my neighborhood, when you think of a drink, reach for a drunk. Because you see, everything we do here, I can put into a big funnel. And when it comes out of the little spout at the bottom, it's really about one alky talking to another. The language of the heart. And when we do that, guess what? Lives get recreated. I'll end on this one thing, you know. I had a good friend, Jack C. You guys probably know Judge Jack from Hagerstown, Maryland. If Jack got to know you, you know, he would, any conference he would go to, he would send you a postcard. Nobody sends postcards anymore, but he would write a postcard. He'd say, hey, Jimmy, I'm in Kingsport, Tennessee. I met Phil. He's really cheap. He didn't take me out for lunch. Great people, all this other stuff. And at the end of that postcard, he would always write this. Sober sure is better. Jack wasn't lying. And if you're new tonight, put one hand in God, one hand in AA. Get in the middle of this triangle, because guess what? Sober sure is better. That's all I got. Thank you.